Going to the gym can be discouraging, especially if you're putting in the work but barely seeing changes. But with Tonal, you can actually see your progress with every workout. Tonal provides the convenience of a full gym and the expertise of a personal trainer anytime at home with one sleek system. Designed to reduce your mental load, Tonal is the ultimate strength training system, helping you focus less on workout planning and more on getting results. No more second-guessing your technique. Tonal gives you real-time coaching cues to dial in your form and help you lift safely and effectively. After a quick assessment, Tonal sets the optimal weight for every move and adjusts in 1 pound increments as you get stronger, so you're always challenged. Tonal lets you choose from a variety of expert-led workouts, from strength to arrow hit to yoga and mobility to keep you coming back for more. For a limited time, go to Tonal.com to get $500 off your Tonal purchase, plus a free 4-year warranty. That's Tonal.com for $500 off, plus a free 4-year warranty. Tonal.com.
This is the Blue Moon Podcast. Coming up, we've got all the news and views from Manchester City's week. It's your club, and this is your show.
Well, I always thought that nothing beats a last-minute winner, but it turns out that it's even better when you get to celebrate that goal once, and then again for a second time when it's been undisallowed by the video ref. At least there was no drama in the 5-0 thumping of Sparta Prague to complete the week. We'll discuss that performance and the display at Molineux on today's Blue Moon Podcast. City have had problems when attacking a back five this season. Guardiola has mentioned it a number of times in his post-match interviews and press conferences, and he talked about it again after the match with Wolves. So why is it so difficult, and what's so difficult different about attacking a back four? We'll hear from the former City defender Nader Manua to find out. And we're going to pull back and take a bigger picture view of City on today's show as well. Simon Bajkowski from the Manchester Evening News joins us later on to speak about his new book. That's all about how City built the environment to thrive under Guardiola and how they got into the position to become the best team in the world. All that to come. I'm David Mooney. With me this week, I've got from One Football, Dan Burke.
Hello, David. How are you doing?
Not too bad, thank you. Not too bad. And from Manchester World, making his podcast debut, Michael Plant.
Hello. I won't ask how you are because you've already answered that. But yes, delighted to be on the pod.
Nice to have you. How are you? I'll ask you. How are you?
Yes, all good. All good. Slightly tired after a late night last night. But yes, all good. Thanks.
Excellent. Dan, you're the only one who hasn't told us how they are. So how are you doing?
Fine, thanks. Yeah.
Good. Good, good. You went to see Interpol last night, did you?
I did indeed, yeah. That was superb. I didn't see the City game as a result, but I did watch Match of the Day, so, you know, ready to discuss all that.
Excellent. Well, we'll come to all of that in a second. We'll hear more from Guardiola about attacking a back five later on as well. But one of the things he said is that it sometimes needs a bit of individual brilliance, like from Guardiola. So I want you to tell me the best piece of individual brilliance you've ever seen on a football pitch. Now, we could be going from like Champions League level City performance, or you could just be down in the park with your mates. Dan, what is the best piece of individual brilliance you've seen?
Well, I don't know if saying a piece of individual brilliance that was pulled off by myself is the correct answer to this question, but I did once score an unbelievable goal playing for a pub Sunday league team. So, like, I was playing up front. It probably shows you how bad the team was, that I was the best option in attack. Someone plays a ball towards me from the left hand side. I'm sort of stood on the edge of the D, essentially, and the ball bounces as it goes past me, and I stuck my leg out to kind of try and control the ball. Didn't control the ball. Instead, the ball flicked off the outside of my foot and lobbed the goalkeeper perfectly from the edge of the box. Now, whether it could be classed as individual brilliance, I don't know, because I had no idea what I was doing and couldn't do it again if my life depended on it. But it was an absolutely outrageous goal, and I will swear blind that I meant to do it.
Excellent. Well, that's the point of individual brilliance, isn't it?
Yeah.
Michael, I'm hoping that yours is about yourself as well, because a little bit of full disclosure, I don't know if you know this happened, but when the media game was going on last summer, and you were playing in the centre of midfield, I think, I was injured on the sidelines, and I was sat with Jack Gorn, and he turned to me and went, "Quite handy, Plancy, isn't he?"
That is probably the nicest thing Jack's ever said about me, so I really will take that as a compliment. I mean, I don't know if it's brilliant or just ridiculous, but I once scored a goal that, similar to Haaland last night, not in any way similar to Erling Haaland, but similar in that the ball bounced at a very awkward height, and it wasn't really, couldn't throw your leg at it, and I kind of just guided it with my knee from the edge of the box, and whatever way I managed to do it just guided it with the inside of my knee into the bottom corner. And everyone just kind of stopped and looked at me and went, that was ridiculous. And I don't know if it was good, lucky, or somewhere in the middle, but yeah, that was one. And I was thinking about individual brilliance last night on the way in, and then Erling Haaland does that. I think that is probably probably one of the most ridiculous individual brilliant things I've ever seen in a football pitch last night alone, to be honest.
Yeah, yeah. And I think all we're proving here, between the three of us at least, maybe not Haaland, but the three of us, you don't have to be good if you're lucky. That's it, isn't it? Yeah. don't have to have any talent if you're lucky.
Funnily enough, I mean, it was the anniversary of the 6-1 this week, wasn't it? And City posted the clip, the David Silva assist for the sixth goal in that game, the famous assist, which is just one of those things that if I had 10 seconds to live, I would want to spend it watching that clip. You know, every time it comes up on the timeline, you have to watch it, don't you? It's just fantastic. And there was people in the comments going, that's not that good. I could do that.
I know.
No, you could not.
I could pull it down out of the sky, take a touch and volley it through two defenders perfectly.
Yeah, yeah.
Someone to run out. No, sorry, mate.
Not that impressive, that. Yeah.
Excellent. Right. Let's turn to the good football. And we're going to start at Molineux. So the winner at Wolves, we'll start there. I've got this. This wouldn't be me if I didn't sit down and actually, you know, thumb through the rule book to find out what what happened. So to clear everything up, if anybody is still in any doubt, it was disallowed on the field for an offside against Bernardo Silva. The VAR then advised the referee to overturn that decision. He went to the monitor and decided there was no offside offence. Now, Bernardo was in an offside position, and that's why the referee was sent to the monitor, because it was a subjective offside and not a factual offside. He can't be active, though, until Stones heads it. So he can't be from the initial corner, because he can't be offside from a corner kick. And he's only active if he interferes with play, that's by touching the ball. If he interferes with an opponent by preventing them from playing it or obscuring their line of sight. If he challenges for the ball or clearly attempts to play the ball. If he makes an action that impacts an opponent's ability to play the ball. And remember, that has to have all happened after Stones has headed it. So ultimately, Dan, none of that happened. The goal was ruled perfectly legal and just. And nothing should be said about it ever again.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know which part of being a City fan I enjoy the most at the moment, whether it's the 90 minutes of football at the weekend or the 48 to 72 hours of gaslighting about the legitimacy of the result that comes every time. It's just so tedious, isn't it? I mean, to be fair, like, I know there was some people complaining about this goal. Most of the comments that I saw, I think people seem to understand that it was fine and it should have, you know, the justice was followed through and it was a legitimate goal. The most troubling kind of reaction that I saw was from people who I think should know a bit better, who were saying, oh, you know, it wasn't a howler. It wasn't clear and obvious. Why have they overturned that? And it's like, I'm sorry, it was. Like, they'd mistakenly disallowed a legitimate goal there. Like, I don't know how you can say that there's any argument for disallowing that goal. I can understand why the linesman, the referee might not have given it in real time, and that's, you know, what VAR should be for correcting those things where the linesman, the referee might not be sure. They disallow the goal, then they have a look and they go, oh, actually, yeah, he wasn't interfering with play. You know, it's a bit of a loophole in the law that we exploited there, I guess, but that law exists for a reason, isn't it? Or otherwise, you'd have offsides after every single corner. I think Bernardo was quite clever to kind of actively get out of the way in the way that he did, in almost sort of like cartoonish way, wasn't
yeah,
it?
He was actively being inactive, wasn't he? Yeah,
yeah, exactly, yeah. But you know that when Stones has the ball, there's no way you can say that he was interfering with play. I think people are just a bit willfully obtuse about these things sometimes, don't they? And they try and bring subjectivity into objective situations all the time. You know, even some people saying the nudge on the goalkeeper should have been a foul. Like, come on, no, it shouldn't. If anything, it's the goalkeeper who's engaged with Bernardo there. So yeah, it was a bit annoying, but yeah, we won. So there we go.
Yeah. Michael, did you have any idea what was going on at the time? Because certainly from the TV pictures, I thought he was going to the screen to disallow the goal. I didn't realise he was going to the screen to actually undisallow it.
Yeah, well, as you know, that, you know, in kind of the 90th minute of a match, you're just frantically head down typing. You just don't want anything to happen. And then there was so much happening. I just couldn't keep, you know, my eyes fully on what was going on. But yeah, truthfully, at the time, I didn't totally know what was going on. But I managed to get the City had scored a goal when everyone celebrated. So, you know, that I can work it out from there, David.
Yeah. But what does it tell you, the fallout from this week? What does it tell you about how people view City? Because ultimately, it feels like the reaction was, that wasn't the decision I wanted. rather than that decision wasn't right or wrong. It just wasn't the one that I wanted. Therefore, it must be wrong.
Yeah, I think there is there are a lot of people out there who, you know, amid the 115 and everything, and the fact that that case is ongoing while Everton and Forest were punished last year, and, like, you know, we're not going to get into all that now, but that is a completely incorrect way of looking at it. But there are people out there who look at it and think that the City case hasn't been dealt with, therefore, you know, they're in bed with the Premier League. And you've got, on the flip side, Man City fans booing the Premier League anthem every time it comes on. So, one of those can't be right. But I think, yeah, there is definitely a little bit of that. I always think this has definitely became the case more since VAR came in, that it is alarming how many people legitimately think there are agendas or conscious biases or people out to get their team. And I reckon if you went through every Premier League club out there, they can point to 7 or 8 incidents and say, yeah, but this happened against us and this happens against us and this is proof of an agenda. And it's just not. I find referee and VAR stuff so tedious sometimes, and it dominates so much now, the media agenda, doesn't it?
Yeah, I do think it would have been even funnier, Dan, if Howard Webb was texting in the stands. Like that could have been the icing on the cake for that goal.
Yeah, I think he'll make a point of not texting in a football stadium ever again, won't he, after that those pictures went round. Yeah, it's true what you say about, like, you know, facts don't care about your feelings, do they? I'm sorry, like, you can't just... People are like sticklers for the rules until they benefit a team they don't like and then they want them changed. Like, no, it doesn't work like that. You know, there was a tweet that I saw from a journalist this morning talking about how City's unbeaten run in Europe shouldn't count because we lost on penalties to Real Madrid. Like, that is not the rule. Like, that's not just not how it works. Like, I don't know. It's just very frustrating the way that people become very sort of childish and let the biases cloud the judgment over these things. We all have biases, of course. You know, I try to think about, you know, situations like that goal at the weekend. What would I think if that had happened to Arsenal or Liverpool or United? I think I would think that it was fair enough and it should be a goal, don't you? Like, it's just, there's no argument against it, I think.
I think they were lucky, that was it. I think they were like, they got away with one. And I don't think there's a City fan out there that doesn't look at that performance in that game and go, you know what, we deserve that. Like a lot of people think we got away with that. And that's exactly what I think I would think if it was Arsenal or Liverpool. So I'm pretty happy to be quite kind of down the middle with that. Michael, City generally this season, it's felt like they've been pretty bad at corners. But then you look at the record recently, Stones has popped up with, I was going to say, 2 vital goals, but he got a third against Sparta as well.
Who needs Erling Haaland when you've got John Stones at corners, eh?
Unbelievable. Yeah, I know.
It's been good. And I mean, you know, I know there's a lot of work done in the winter break last year. They went away and worked on set pieces and they came back, I think it was in January, and scored something like 3 of the 4 games back. They scored from set pieces. And I think that has carried on a little bit into this point of the season. And I think they are better at set pieces, certainly attacking-wise, City. And look, if you can add other strings to your bow, other ways of scoring goals, then, you know, it only makes City more dangerous, doesn't it? And I don't think they always need other ways of scoring, but yeah, it's certainly a good thing to add to the repertoire.
Yeah, what do you think of the performance? Because I spent a lot of that game thinking they weren't very good. And then it was only after I watched Match of the Day and watched the highlights, I realised actually they created a fair number of chances. They were mainly shots outside the box, but they created enough to have said, actually, they probably just about deserve the win.
Yeah, I think you can make an argument to say they deserve the win, but I also think you can probably make an argument to say, well, Wolves defended so well, so they deserve the point. I think those both things can be true, although they obviously do contradict each other. But I thought the first half was good at Molineux, and they obviously went behind, they stayed calm, they stayed relaxed, didn't, you know, lose their heads at any point, which, I mean, City don't do anyway, do they? But and they created plenty of chances, albeit, as you said, no clear-cut chances. And, you know, if you do take enough shots from distance, there is every chance that one of them eventually will go in, and obviously Vardy all did get that. But I thought the second half, I thought the didn't push on. I thought at halftime, even after about an hour, right, they're going to push on here and going to get this goal. Similar actually to the Arsenal game a couple of weeks ago, and they just didn't manage to do it, obviously, until the very latter stages and John Stones popped up. So I didn't think it was a great performance. Pep said post-match that he thought it was, which I was a little bit surprised at, but Pep just sometimes likes to throw a little curveball in there, doesn't he? And yeah, we don't see football all the same as Pep, and in general, I think he's right and we're wrong. But yeah, I didn't think it was a great performance. performance. But at the same time, when you're getting 3 points, it doesn't matter. And look, you know, we've spoken about this so many times over the years, but City at this stage of the season aren't always great. But as long as you're picking up the wins and you can potentially come good in March, April, May, does it really matter? Probably not.
Yeah, exactly that. And I mean, the other side of it, Dan, I wonder how much of it is clouded by the fact that City went behind. Like, they went behind to that counter-attack, and then they had another counter-attack that Edison had to save. But so, like, immediately we all think, oh, this isn't going very well. And then actually, even though City dominate it for an hour, they create a lot more shooting chances before Wolves have another attack. We still think of those two really good chances that they'd had at the start of the game and think, well, City aren't really doing it here, when actually they are.
Yeah, I just think they were poor overall with and without the ball, really. I found it a really frustrating game to watch. It was like the ball was moving really slowly to the point where I was like, is that ball fully inflated that they're playing with there? It felt like, you know, someone sat on it and made it egg-shaped or something. It was just weird the way the ball was moving slowly. Like, Haaland had no service. It was one of those games where he marked out the game. You know, there was a lack of kind of ingenuity to the play. I think it got a bit better when Foden and Grealish came on. And when the team was announced and Doku and Savinho were started, I was like, oh, here we go. This will be an exciting game. I'm glad to see those two on the team sheet. As the game goes on, you sort of wonder, maybe this would have been better for Grealish, you know, someone who's a bit more considered and calm on the ball, you know, not trying to take players on as soon as he gets it. But, you know, the finishing was quite wild at times as well. Savinho had that good shot that was saved, but he also had a few ways sort of lashed it over, and, you know, there was just a bit of a lack of composure when with the chances they did get. And, you know, you're sort of looking at the game as it's drifting towards the end, and then you start analysing the draw and thinking, you know, what does this mean for the season so far? I don't think City were that great against Newcastle, against Fulham either. Not great in this game. Like Michael says, though, it's, you know, that they're a point off the top of the league and haven't lost yet this season, despite not being at the best. So you would hope that they would grow into the season. And I think the way this game went, you know, people complain about City being boring, don't they, all the time? But when they play against a side like Wolves who want to put men behind the ball like they did and shut down the space and really take the game down to the gutter, I don't know what you can really expect City to do about that. It's difficult, and that is what makes the game boring. Not that I have a problem with teams like Wolves doing that at all. You know, they need to get a point or better out of the game, and that's the best way for them to do it. It doesn't make for a very entertaining spectacle, unfortunately, but, you know, City have got to find ways to get around that, and hopefully someone like De Bruyne coming back soon can add a bit of spark that's been missing in recent weeks, and create those little moments of magic that I think I've been lacking a little bit with the attacking play recently. Foden, I'm hoping he'll kick on a little bit more now, because it's been quite frustrating that he's not started the season in the way that he finished the last one. I think there's obviously reasons for that. I'm playing at the Euros, the amount of games that he's played last season, I think he's needed some time to kind of recover. But yeah, I'm hoping that we'll start to see some better performances as we head towards the winter period.
Yeah. Speaking of better performances, Michael, as well, it's been quite a week for Matías Núñez. He came on and had an impact at Molineux, scored and assisted against Sparta. And I know Sparta, not the top end of the European opposition that City will face, but, you know, they still needed dismantling. They still needed beating. And like Dan said, they were sitting in just as deep as Wolves were at times. And Núñez was a big part of City unlocking that door.
Yeah, I thought he played really well last night. And I thought the tackle, actually, when he came on at Molineux, was brilliant. Really, really important tackle at a really important time. And I think it launched a counter-attack for City. It's been difficult for Núñez, obviously, and he's an attacking midfielder who has been signed in a team with Kevin De Bruyne and Phil Foden. It is difficult for him to get minutes. I think it was interesting that he played out left last night. Truthfully, I don't think that is a long-term position for him. I think he was put out there because, obviously, Doku and Grealish weren't available. But all you can do is, when you're given that opportunity, play well. And that was probably his best performance in a City shirt. And that's probably the second or third time I've said that in recent weeks, which would maybe show a general improvement. And I think as well, when he has played in the past, he hasn't brought a huge amount of incision in terms of creating attacking moves, providing assists and goals. And I mean, he scored two goals now. Okay, albeit one was a penalty. Scored two goals in the last couple of weeks. Provided two assists last night and then won the penalty from which he scored. So, I mean, he essentially set up three goals, didn't he? So, yeah, I think an encouraging sign. And look, if he can push on now, he certainly wouldn't be the first player ever to come in, have a bit of a struggle in his first season under Guardiola, and second season push on a little bit. So hopefully from a City perspective, obviously that is the case.
Yeah, a nice penalty as well, Dan. And if you remember back to the Community Shield, when he stepped up for that one, my gut instinct was, well, this one's flying over the bar. And then he absolutely wellied that one in. So fair play to him.
Yeah, maybe we've got a new penalty taker option finally. Yeah. Yeah, I've been impressed with Nunez in recent weeks. I think, you know, when he joined the club last year, there was a queue to get in the team, wasn't there? He quickly jumped ahead of Calvin Phillips in that queue, but they never really got any closer to play in than that last season. And last time I was on the podcast was just after City had signed Gundogan back. And I was wondering then, like, is there really any point in Nunez sticking around? Is he going to get a game now? You know, I couldn't see how he was going to get in the team. I think he was in danger of becoming the new Calvin Phillips this year, actually. And obviously circumstances have changed significantly since then with the Rodri injury and Nunez has moved up the pecking order. I think that assist that he got for Haaland against West Ham was like a really big moment for him. I think he's starting to contribute now in a way that he didn't, you know, barely at all last season. I feel like the fans are beginning to appreciate what he can bring as well. I'm seeing some positive things on Twitter about him these days. And I think his value to City now is going to be as a utility player, you know, the sort of new Fabian Delph Zinchenko perhaps. I don't think he's ever going to be good enough to be a permanent fixture in midfield when everyone's fit, but I think he can fill in on the wing. Maybe he can fill in as a fullback at some point. Maybe, you know, I wouldn't be against trying him in a holding role as well. I think he's got the tenacity for it. He's got a tackle in him, as we saw against Wolves at the weekend. And I think all good teams need a team player, someone who can fill in and do a job, and I'm confident that Nunez can be a useful player for us now this season, which is it's been a nice change in recent weeks.
Yeah, he's got pace as well, which a lot of the other midfielders at the moment don't really have in abundance. So seeing him get back against Wolves was quite a good thing, because, you know, Kovacic and Gundogan were being bypassed a few times and they just couldn't get back the right side of the ball. So that'll be useful as well. Yeah. A couple of other bits of we talked about individual brilliance earlier on. We've mentioned Haaland already. By my count, Dan, that's the third time he's done something like that. Guardiola talked about the Dortmund goal in the post-match press conference. Everyone seems to have forgotten the goal at Southampton away, I think in his first season.
The overhead kick, yeah.
So he's the length that man will go to not have to head the ball, eh?
He's pretty good. But you know what? He had a really good header in the first half last night, didn't he? That I was really impressed by the way he sort of shaped his body to get around the ball and head it. And the goalkeeper made a good save. So maybe that's something that he's getting a little bit better at, his aerial presence as well. And yeah, I mean, what a piece of ingenuity, improvisation that goal was last night. You know, he's got those incredible telescopic legs and, you know, can manipulate his limbs in the way that a lot of players can't. And I think, didn't Foden say after the game that if he tried that, he would have pulled his groin or something? I think, you know, most people would have done as well. So it's just, he's just an outrageously good goal scorer, as we've all seen. I think he's having a really good season so far. You know, wasn't great at the weekend and hadn't scored for a couple of games going into the Sparta game. So good to see him getting back on the horse scoring wise, and hopefully he can keep going now and get a few more goals this weekend, and then you know, really start to put some distance between him and the others when it comes to that golden boot race.
Yeah, and at the other end of the pitch, Michael, Edison one-on-one again at Molineux, another good save.
Yeah, he's having a good couple of weeks, isn't he? Obviously, the Fulham game, I thought he was brilliant and, you know, essentially won City 3 points. And Guardiola spoke about him a lot after that match, was asked a couple of questions, of course, with him nearly leaving in the summer. But yeah, and it's funny, really. I feel like the conversation is slightly shifting with Ortega now, that for so many years we've talked about what he does with the ball at his feet, but actually I think there is a growing appreciation that he is actually a very good goalkeeper, you know, with his hands, funny enough. But he's had a good couple of weeks, hasn't he? And that save against Wolves was really, really good and an important time, because if City would have gone 2-0 down then, I think that could have been a really difficult match to come back from, actually. And so it was a really important save, and yeah, he's having a good couple of weeks, as I say.
Going to the gym can be discouraging, especially if you're putting in the work but barely seeing changes. But with Tonal, you can actually see your progress with every workout. Tonal provides the convenience of a full gym and the expertise of a personal trainer anytime at home with one sleek system. Designed to reduce your mental load, Tonal is the ultimate strength training system, helping you focus less on workout planning and more on getting results. No more second-guessing your technique. Tonal gives you real-time coaching cues to dial in your form and help you lift safely and effectively. After a quick assessment, Tonal sets the optimal weight for every move and adjusts in 1 pound increments as you get stronger, so you're always challenged. Tonal lets you choose from a variety of expert-led workouts, from strength to aero hit to yoga and mobility, to keep you coming back for more. For a limited time, go to Tonal.com to get $500 off your Tonal purchase, plus a free 4-year warranty. That's Tonal.com for $500 off, plus a free 4-year warranty. Tonal.com.
Here in America, work is in trouble. We've offshored our manufacturing, sent away good jobs, and lost so much ability to make things. American Giant is a company that's pushing back against this tide. They make high-quality clothing, sweatshirts, jeans, dresses, jackets, and so much more, right here in the USA. Visit American-Giant.com and get 20% off your first order when you use code STAPLE20 at checkout. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com, promo code STAPLE20.
Ad-free episodes are available on Patreon. Sign up at patreon.com/Blue Moon Podcast.
Now, we've talked about City struggling to attack and break down the opposition a bit recently. And Guardiola said a few times this season already that when the opposition have played a back five, it's been really hard for City to break through. So to try and explain why and what City can do to get the upper hand, I've asked the former City defender Nader Manua all about it.
I actually liked playing in a back three slash back five because it allows you sort of space to be a bit more aggressive. I think historically when you play in a back four, you're always having to make decisions, say, as a centre-back, whether do I go to this person or do I not? Like, if I go, am I leaving lots of space? Whereas when you go into a three, the central one can do lots of covering and the others can be just that little bit more aggressive. I think we saw, you know, a few years ago when when City unfortunately lost to Chelsea in that Champions League final. You've seen, like, Rudiger and Azpilicuetas and others who are getting really tight and aggressive, some might say a bit too aggressive, to people that they're up against. So I like it because, as I say, it can make you be more on the front foot, whereas when you're in the back four, you're always worried about space and the decision-making. Like playing against the false nine when you're in the back four is really tricky because what do you go and do? Whereas, say, if you're playing against the false nine in a back three or a back five, then somebody can go and try and affect it and still have structure behind you. So I think a manager saying it, I think it, in some ways, the people who probably feel the most stressed are people who are potentially wing-backs. But if you're playing against a side that's going to keep lots of the ball anyway, then it's just a defensive five, and that's fine. Like, you spend lots of time in training, working on defending as a collective. And I think when you go back five, maybe attackers are a bit upset because they feel like maybe it's too much on the back foot. But defensively, you'll always have bodies around you because the gaps between you, they're never going to be that big because you have more players around it.
Yeah, I mean, I saw it suggested at the weekend with Wolves and City that ultimately with Wolves playing three centre backs like really tight around Erling Haaland, there's so little space for him. Like, does it make sense for City to switch to a false nine in that instance?
Not necessarily, because another thing about say back threes versus back fives and so on. Say if you assume that they play something like a 5-4-1, but they're going to be in a low block, that's a lot of bodies in a central area. And you could, say, switch to a false nine and so on. But in reality, you're not really going to be budging the Wolves players because they're still all there. And they're all there in the most key area, which is right in front of goal. And what I thought Wolves did well overall was every time the ball, say, went to Doku, went to Savinho, went to Grealish and so on, you know, you'd have Semedo out there, you'd have Aitnori out there, but you'd also have a midfielder out there. So there's always a 2-1 in that favour. But that still doesn't mean that there's anything changed centrally because the three centre-backs are still there and the midfielders are still there. So for Erling, like, this is what I think a lot of people forget because they'll judge him, like, how many touches did he have? How was the game? And I think if a team was playing on a back four, he'd probably get the fewest touches anyway because they will protect the middle. But when you do play with three centre-backs, you know, it's basically 3-1. You could go to a false nine, but then you still have all those bodies in the middle, and those bodies in the middle, there's always one that will be allowed to go out and try and affect it in terms of applying pressure or making tackles. It was very, very hard for City to sort of break through them because the bodies are there. They're so well drilled, and we've seen this like so many times, say, across the years. And for City, you hope that when you get an opportunity, you can make the most of it, but the opportunities that you'll come across, they'll be very difficult. Like, as we saw again, it was not just Wolves. Like, Arsenal did it, was it 3-4 weeks ago? It's the same sort of idea. And when teams do get into that back five, you can basically, you're encouraged to play the ball out wide. But then when you do go out wide, it's not necessarily just 1v1s. And a ball that goes into the box, they'll always have a numerical advantage because you can't overcommit. And as was the case with Arsenal, as was the case with Wolves, if you do overcommit, there's a chance you'll get hit on the break. So it's this really incredible and interesting game of cat and mouse where how do you break down a team that's happy to defend that also has the threat on the break as well?
Yeah, it's interesting. In fact, I want to play this. This was Guardiola speaking in the press conference after the game, and he talked. He was asked about the difficulties about attacking a back five, and he kept coming back to the transitions. This is what he said:
the tipos play four in the back, play against us, they play five in the back, and play there in the holding midfielders, no close, like a whole hands with the central defenders. So, what do you need? Just goal. Action for winger, good cross, good shoot. Basically, stay a lot in the position that you have to be. This is really, really important. Don't become crazy. Otherwise, they make the transitions, and after that, they punish you. There's 11 players inside of the box when we arrive in the byline. 11 players inside. It's no space, you know? And after, yes, free kicks, corners, individual action, like Josko has done again. So you can break in this kind of way. But the most important when you are there is try to avoid as much as possible the runners, the transition for the opener. If you open that door, it's impossible. They destroy you, for sure, 100%.
And I'm wondering if kind of the sort of cat and mouse game that City get into there, like how do you stop the opposition then from being able to get onto the ball and break really quickly and cause you those problems? Because we saw they needed Edison to make a one-on-one save. Obviously, Wolves scored with a counter-attack like that. Is that a major problem there for City going forward if they keep coming up against back fives?
No, not necessarily, because not every team will essentially have the speed, for example, to be able to take the ball up the field. And every team is really going to be that good in transition, and they might not have enough attackers who, you know, have the ability to run forward in transition, but then also be very disciplined when they're defending as well. Because in reality, like these players in the Premier League, they don't want to play a game without having touches of the ball. And there is a level of disappointment, and it's harder physically to do because you're just running around. Basically, someone's telling you where to go as opposed to you dictating it yourself. And in some ways, like what Guardiola said there, I'm glad he said it because it's how I think about football. Let's say you go back to the Arsenal game, there was so much criticism for, say, like Ruben Dias having a shot at the edge of the box or such and such a person. Say, why doesn't Foden just do it and Dias go higher, blah, blah, blah. Was because you still need the best defenders to be in a position to defend should the ball turn over on the edge of the box. And that's something that City do very, very well. And it's why, say, some teams who do drop into a really low block don't get a ton of chances. Like, they might get some, but they won't get a ton of chances because those guys like Invardiol, Diaz, Stones, Akanjis, Walkers, Rico Lewis's, like they counter-press really well when there's a turnover and their decision-making is second to none. And Guardiola knows that. I think from the outside, people think this is like a magical formula to just be able to break a side down, just move this into this position or move that into that position. But these guys, they know how to do the City play games. They know how to defend. And they know that the moment there's a turnover, if there's space, they're going to try and get into it. So you need your best defenders to be there to deal with it. And with all due respect, Phil Foden, Jeremy Doku, Savinho's, people like this, they're not the best ones to be able to defend a transition. So I don't think it's a thing that you should be worried about as such, but I do believe that when teams do set up in that way, that's the way they're going to play. They won't just play against City, they'll be playing against Arsenal, they'll be playing against Liverpool, against sides who want to keep possession, like Brighton's, for example, as well. And that's just the nature of football, because at times, if you look at the way that one team is compared to another, can Wolves go toe-to-toe with City in a sort of like passing match? Absolutely not. So what's going to give them the best chance to be successful? Well, it's the way they scored their goal on the weekend. And it's the way that they created one or two like half chances and opportunities for the rest of the game. And I think Guardiola knows, the City players know, that if a team gives them space, City can thrive, they can have an absolute field day. So for the other teams, they have to try and limit space. But I think this is the critique that, say, Arsenal had a few weeks ago. You still kind of need something in attack as well if you want to try and win the game. And I think Wolves had that potential, and they're disappointed, but they're also a team that, you know, have no real form at this moment in time. So I wouldn't say it's a thing against City. I think it's just the way that those games go. And we saw it with England in the summer. We've seen it with other like big teams who want to keep possession, really pinning teams back. Unfortunately, games where a team plays a low block, they're not exciting games overall. But there are games where the team that has the possession, if they overcommit, they will be punished. And Guardiola is very aware of that because he's probably seen it for the last 10 years of his managerial career.
Yeah, just a couple of other things I'd want to ask you about around the tactical breakdown of attacking a back five, because you think back to that Arsenal game. One of the things Guardiola said he was really pleased with what that City were doing in that was not giving Arsenal the opportunity to buy a free kick and to buy a way out. And that was when Arsenal win possession back in their own defensive third, don't put too much pressure on them, because you don't give them the chance to go down under pressure. You don't give them the chance to just relieve some of that pressure. They have to boot it long and give it back to us. And like as a defender in those situations, is that frustrating? Because actually what you want a couple of minutes where actually you can, the game is dead, you can get the ball on the ground and you can move everybody up to the halfway line.
Yeah, I think in times gone by when, say, your team's basically struggling without possession, and there are times when you can be out of possession and still sort of dictate the game. But when that's not the case, then yeah, winning free kicks is massive, because what it allows you to do is take time. And I think the more time that you can kill, like, I think Arsenal were being criticised for it, for the dark arts and whatever, but historically that's just the way that football goes. You know, yellow cards have been given for time wasting for as long as we can remember. You know, you've had times where people try and manage the game, and if it's your team, you say, oh, this is a great thing to do, take as much time as you need. And for teams playing against City like Arsenal in that moment, you know, you've been under pressure for long periods. It's not, and with City, it's not like 30 seconds or a minute or 2 minutes at times. It's 5 minutes, it's 10 minutes. So people that can win free kicks, or people that can take the ball upfield, people that can contest some of those longer balls and be able to create a spark, you know, win a set piece. Like, if you don't have a ton of possession, then yes, it comes down at times to transitions and set pieces. So if you can win them in your half, yes, you can buy time. If you win them in the opposition's half, maybe now you could punish them. And it's just the way that, say, the games end up sometimes. Like, before we start every game, we have an idea of how you want to play the game, how you want to win the game, but very quickly realize that maybe that is not what's needed in any particular moment. And so you do champion people who win free kicks. And, you know, when we look at it from a City perspective, times when City have been under pressure at some of the bigger rivals, whether it's Champions League and knockout competitions, and someone wins a free kick in the corner, you celebrate that as much as, say, the goal that was scored 10 minutes earlier.
I always think of Gareth Barry as the one that could just buy a free kick out of nowhere. But yeah,
I remember years ago, I think it was Alano and another Brazilian counterpart were in a corner against Bolton at home, and I think they kept it in the corner for 5 minutes, and it was the most remarkable thing I've ever seen, and probably one of the highlights of the whole game. Like, those moments do matter, because it can frustrate the opposition who are trying to be chasing and so on. And I think for City, to look about how you go up against that, they want to be aggressive, but you can't be too aggressive. But I think overall, the way that they play, the way the manager is on the side, like, it's funny, the way most people feel about, say, playing against the back five, and when, like, Haaland doesn't get many touches, they get frustrated and say, oh, just do this. But then one of the greatest minds in football explains why they can't do that. But still, some people, it's just not enough. But then for some of those people, wouldn't have been successful as, say, Guardiola has been, because he gets the balance just right. You know, he understands what teams want to do, understands their tendencies. And if he was in the same situation as the opposition, he'd probably try and get them to do the same things that would probably cause City problems. So I'm all for listening to maybe the greatest manager in Premier League history.
Yeah, I accept that. I wondered as well, do you think he swapped at halftime, he swapped Doku and Savinho over to put them on their more natural side? So the right footer on the right side, left footer on the left side. And I wondered if that was, do you think that's a move to kind of try and drag the fullbacks out a little bit further and then create a little bit more space between those three centre-backs?
Possibly. But then I think what Wolves did well, I thought, just throughout the game, was very rarely was it just a 1v1. I think the midfielders were getting across quite well to sort of make it feel like a 2v1. And I think for Guardiola, maybe it's a case of if you can really threaten to get the ball down to the line, maybe they'll defend a bit differently. Perhaps there'll then be space for a cutback as such. And it just offers a different sort of question for the opposition. Because now, as I say, the body shape has to be different. Like, if Savinho's on the right, if Doku's on the left, they can go down the line, but you kind of get a feeling that they want to go central. And when that's the case, you know, another midfielder or a centre-back could step into that space to try and block a shot. Whereas, as I say, if you can take somebody down the line, maybe it feels more like a 1v1. But it's an interesting tactical tweak that they can do. And I thought when Grealish came on as well on that left-hand side, he felt like he was coming more down the line than coming inside as well. So clearly it was a trait that the manager wanted to see. And I think the manager's good in terms of just trying to offer different questions to the opposition, like questions that they have to answer, instead of just sticking with one thing. And it's not to say that the other thing wasn't working, but maybe this is a tougher question for them to be able to manage, or a different look, and the players playing a different way. So it worked to a certain extent, But I think the players for Wolves, you know, they're obviously disappointed they conceded in that last minute, but they had to work very, very, very hard to even be in the game at that point. But in the end, you know, City have found their way, and that's kind of what champions do, isn't it?
If you enjoy the show, please give it a rating and a review wherever you get your podcasts.
That was Nadum and Nua talking about attacking a back five. Dan, do you reckon City are going to have to do that again this weekend? Because Southampton they've had an interesting start to the season in that they seem to have a philosophy, and that philosophy seems to be let everybody else do what they want.
Yeah, they played a back five against Arsenal the other week, and I suppose almost got a result there, didn't they? They went 1-0 up, and I'm sure they'll have a similar game plan for this one this week. I mean, Russell Martin last week against Leicester, after the Leicester game, didn't he pretty publicly called out one of his own players after that late winner? Didn't name them, but you know, it was pretty obvious who he meant. And that kind of feels like the death rattle of any managerial tenure when the manager starts turning on the players, doesn't it? And I think Southampton, they've come up a year too soon. They don't look good enough for the Premier League to me. So I think they're going to really struggle and might want to make a change for in the managerial position soon. But for us this weekend, it's going to be tricky because I don't think there's a lot of options, really. I mean, Doku's going to be out, definitely, I think. Grealish probably is going to be out. So it's probably going to be a similar lineup against Sparta with Savinho on the right and Nunes on the left. Maybe he'll move Bernardo out wide instead and bring Kovacic back in, move Gundogan further forward, you know. I don't think Gundogan's been that great so far this season. I think he's still refining his feet a little bit. So there's not a depth of options for Guardiola to choose from here. And I think when it comes to breaking down these low blocks, especially when it's a back five, the width is really crucial. I think they were better in the second half against Sparta when Savinho was encouraged to be a bit more aggressive with the ball and go at the fullback a little bit more and get some crosses into the box. And, you know, Haaland can thrive on those if it's a good enough cross. Having De Bruyne back soon would be a massive boost, I think, for a game like this as well, just to kind of deliver one of those moments of magic that I mentioned earlier. But I doubt he'll be ready to start for 90 minutes. So, you know, I think there's plenty of reasons to be confident about this game at the weekend, but it could be one of those attritional affairs for a little while if we don't break the deadlock really early or even go behind like we have done a few times lately as well.
Yeah. I'm interested in your thoughts in this, Michael, because after the Wolves game, Guardiola said this.
The other option is, okay, you don't come, I don't come. We go with Eddie and we stay there. But who decide to come? That will be so difficult for our spectators. So imagine Ruben has the ball and say, okay, I don't attack, stay there. What happened? So I don't know what happened, but will be a problem.
And then at 3-0 against Sparta, Akanji got the ball and did nothing with it until Sparta came out of their own half and decided to come and press him. And Sam Lee then asked Pep if he was trying what he'd said after the Wolves game. And Pep said this.
No, I don't want to try, but what would happen if we do that for the first minute? What would happen in the football?
Maybe they'll press.
I don't think so. Maybe. Okay, come, we'll see. But if they don't attack, I don't want to attack. What happened?
But it worked tonight. You scored.
Yeah, we scored when they were deep and we scored when they jammed. You know that? With 2-0, they don't want to come. Why should I attack? Okay, we won the game. We go there. But of course, we are fans and we have to attack. So in football, for the rules, one team can stay 90 minutes in the 8-yard box, nothing, make a transition goal. Oh, it's a masterclass. Master genius. And what a vision. No, you want an episodic action, one transition, one corner, or whatever. And I said to the players, what you have to do is how we attack better against teams that defend so deep. There is just one thing we cannot forget. Don't be impatient. Step by step, we are going to improve how we can attack this type of teams.
Now, I know you asked him about patience after the Wolves game. So let's imagine City kick off, Southampton drop deep and don't leave their box, and City don't move it forward. What happens then?
Guardiola's football, that's it. It goes full circle. It goes back from complete dominance, incredible movement, you know, unbelievable sight, to just everyone stands still and nothing happens. No, it's interesting because that where the defender just stood on the ball and waited, that happened 3 or 4 times actually last night in the match, and I was sitting beside Sam and we were watching it, and It was very interesting. I mean, Guardiola, he does this every season, doesn't he? There's a little new tactical instruction that he tries to implement or a little thing that he tries to change. I don't think that will be the case this season. Certainly that answer last night seemed to suggest that. But it is really interesting to see that is there a way of somehow just getting the team to push, the opposition to just push up 10 yards. And suddenly if they push up 10 yards, it completely changes the outlook for City, doesn't it, in possession. And last night, you could see when Akanji was just standing on the ball saying, come on, come on. And they were just slowly, kind of yard by yard, creeping forward. And then, click of a finger. So suddenly City were in behind. Haaland's turning his right foot and finishing. So it'd be really interesting to see that one going forward. But I don't know. I think there'll be opposition teams that will just say, that's fine. We'll just stand here. We'll just stand here in our own half and just wait for you guys to eventually come on this.
But I really want to see what would happen, because it'd be a ridiculous spectacle to watch Southampton stay in their own box and City just keep the ball on their own penalty area and not move it. Be like that Simpsons episode, Dan, where it's the World Cup and
I was thinking exactly that as well.
It's Springfield, and they just pass it around the edge of the box. It'd just be the real life version of that meme.
Yeah. Oh, think City are boring, do you? You ain't seen nothing yet.
Yeah. Yeah. I wondered, though, actually, Dan, it might work away from home better than at home, because if you've got 50,000 City fans watching this, we're all obviously going to sit there and go, what the hell are you doing? Can you try and score a goal, please? But if you're doing it at Molineux, then you might have all the Wolves fans going, well, they're not doing anything with it. Go and get it off them. And then suddenly that encouragement could make them attack the game differently.
Yeah, I think it works the other way as well, in that like a team that's sort of defending, like, putting men behind the ball, getting men in the box, like that's a lot easier to do on your home pitch, I think, really, when the crowd are behind you, when they're cheering every tackle. I think a team like Southampton come and try and do that for 90 minutes at the weekend, it's going to be very intense for them. And, the home crowd are going to be getting right behind City, urging them forward, and it's difficult for them to expect to keep a clean sheet in a game like that. And if probably not going to score many goals either. So it's tricky. So yeah, I don't see Guardiola using this weird tactic very much again, but maybe there is something in there, this kind of bait in the press thing that's become quite popular in football in recent years. I think, Roberto De Zerbi's Brighton kind of kicked off the trend a couple of years ago, and City do use an element of it. That was an extreme example of it last night that perhaps aren't going to do too much of. But especially when you're like, what was City 2-3-0 up in the game when they did that as well? Yeah. So it's like,
it was 3-0, like, and Guardiola's answer was, well, we're winning 3-0, so we're winning the game. Come and do something. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think at the weekend, it's Southampton, a 0-0 draw, they'd bite your hand off for that, wouldn't they? So there's not really going to be much opportunity for us to do that unless we're 2-3 up in the game as well. So yeah, it's an interesting little tactical idea for sure. Yeah.
You see stats pop up all the time about clubs and players, and you want to know that exact thing about City. There's an answer. Statcity.co.uk. Want to find out all of the players who played alongside club legends like David Silva, Sergio Aguero or Vincent Kompany? Or maybe you'd like to know which team found it hardest to score past Joe Hart. You can find out City's record in every competition, at every stadium, and under every manager. Just go to statcity.co.uk and browse away. That's statcity.co.uk.
These days, work is in trouble. We've outsourced most of our manufacturing to other countries. And with that, we sent away good jobs and our capability to make things. American Giant is a clothing company that's pushing back against this tide. They make all kinds of high-quality clothing and activewear, like sweatshirts, jeans, dresses, jackets, and so much more, right here in the USA. So when you buy American Giant, you create jobs in towns and cities across the country. And jobs bring pride. Purpose. They stitch people together. If all that sounds good to you, visit American-Giant.com and get 20% off your first order when you use code STAPLE20 at checkout. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com with promo code STAPLE20.
Get your ears around our bonus episodes every Monday. Patreon.com/Blue Moon Podcast.
I imagine, Michael, they won't need to do it at Spurs, because the difference between Southampton, or how Southampton might approach the game and how Spurs will approach the game, could be night and day. It's interesting on this one, because after the League Cup win over Watford, Guardiola effectively said this competition could, because of the schedule, no longer be prioritised as it was in the past. Do you see him make... I mean, is there leeway to make any changes given the injuries in the squad at the minute?
I think the only way really is if he does turn to the youth players, which is something Guardiola is very reluctant to do, really. And I did have a look that the EDS team play the night before, which I don't think would be... I mean, at the end of the day, if Guardiola wants to pick a couple of youth team players, I don't think that's going to be a factor, really. But, you know, having them play means that he maybe just doesn't have the full repertoire of players to turn to and pick from. But yeah, I think the number of issues at the moment is probably something that is not being spoken about enough, because I think it is really concerning for City, because obviously we've got the two long-term ones with Rodri and Bob, and then you've got these four shorter-term ones. But to have six players out when you have a squad of, I don't know how many outfield players, 19, 20, and Guardiola last night said, oh, we've only got 15 outfield players to choose from, plus the goalkeepers. And, you know, you can name 12 substitutes last night. City named seven. Two of them were goalkeepers. It is really concerning, actually. And, you know, I've had this conversation many times over the years and thought, well, you know, they need to go and add more numbers to the ranks. And then they go and win the title at the end of the season. You think, well, you know, the ends justify the means. You know, he's obviously right. But you do maybe wonder in this season whether he will have to, you know, maybe make a few additions in the January market, as I say, particularly because of these two long-term injuries. But back to Spurs, which is what you originally asked me. I'd be interested to see what team he does put out. I think that unless he turns to youth team, I don't think there's going to be a huge amount of option to rest and rotate. And yeah, maybe that's what it is. Maybe just say, do you know what, lads, just stand on the ball, and that way you don't have to exert yourself in any way. Don't get fatigued. And both teams will do it. They'll play the last 10 minutes and just see what happens.
Yeah, I wonder if the other angle is just to go, well, you know what, let them have it, see what happens. just chip the ball into the Spurs half, see if they give something away. Dan, if it is to be fringe and youth players, and should Tottenham decide to go slightly stronger, it'll probably end up with a Tottenham win. Given City's history in the Carabao Cup and what the League Cup means to the City fans, it is a little bit annoying, but the schedule kind of does demand it, doesn't it?
Yeah, and that history is part of history now a bit, isn't it? Like it's been a while since we've sort of really gone for the Carabao Cup. I think Pep has realised over time that it can be a bit of a problem if you exert too much in the early part of the season, and they've kind of gone out with a whimper a couple of times in recent years. You know, like a bit like the Newcastle game last season. I think that it'll be a similar kind of story this weekend, where it's a much changed team, a couple of youngsters in there. We'll probably give a decent fight, but ultimately lose the game. And I have no problem with that, really. I think we do have to prioritise and manage minutes and the squad that we have. You know, like Michael said, there's a few players missing at the moment, which isn't ideal. So I think Spurs are going to go for it, because I think, you know, Ange Postecoglou made that point of saying that he always wins something in his second season. So I think he's probably going to have that played on his mind, and this is a good opportunity for him to win something. And I think the Spurs fans were quite pissed off that they went out in the early rounds of the Carabao last year, because it was a good opportunity for them there. So I'd expect they'd go pretty much full strength, and I'd expect we'd rotate a lot. Ortega will play, you know, players that are coming back a little bit into it will probably get some minutes, like Ake, like De Bruyne perhaps. I think James McAtee should play 90 minutes. I think Nico O'Reilly should play 90 minutes. And the stuff about the, you know, the young players that we have as well, and not using too many academy players, it's a bit of a debate sometimes to be had there with Pep sometimes, the way that he does build his bench when he's... It almost seems like he's sort of cutting his nose off to spite his face. Like, could we not just pull a couple of lads out of the EDS and put them on the bench for, like, you know, a bit of experience of being in and around the first team? You know, does it make more sense to have them playing for the EDS at the weekend when they could be sat on the bench? I don't know, really. It tends to be the case that Pep leans towards not using them and having a smaller bench and putting two goalkeepers on there. But yeah, I'd like to see a few players given a chance, really. And this is a good opportunity to do so, even if it means we probably do end up losing the game.
Yeah. Well, we'll see how it goes. We're currently on £525 for the season on the charity bet so far. We were one goal away from winning on both of the last two games, so hopefully we can get a right outcome this time. William Hill is giving us three £10 correct score singles, and the winnings are going to the Man City Fans Food Bank Support Group. They're again collecting in the usual spot on Saturday between 1 and 2:30 p.m. And there's something extra going on at the collection too. Nick from the group sent us this voice note to explain.
Some of you may know, 2 weeks ago, we met with the Premier League at their head offices to discuss concerns around ticket pricing increases and erosion of concessions, which I think anyone who goes to matches will agree is, you know, pricing out traditional support, affects atmospheres for years now, and is a risk to the future of all of our clubs as we know them. We all heard the news last week about the club confirming to City Matters that they are not reintroducing season tickets. And that's terrifying to me anyway, to think that our own club doesn't want new season ticket holders in the stadium. How are the new generations of support meant to come through? With that in mind, this Saturday at 2 p.m. outside of our collection point, opposite the Asda under the bridge, we'll be displaying a banner that says Stop Exploiting Loyalty as one small part of a nationwide protest at nearly every fixture this weekend and the weekend after. We'll be joined by a City's Disabled Supporters Association, the Solid Citizens Campaign Group, 1894 Group, and most importantly, travelling Southampton supporters too, as this is about football supporters across the country coming together, which we almost never do. But the last time we did, we won £30 away cap, which was so important. So, you know, the power of us when we do come together as a collective, it can't be overlooked, as unfortunately it so often is by our clubs. So we invite all Blues to come and join us 2 o'clock before kickoff this Saturday for a photo with the banner. Bring your scarves and check MCFC Food Bank on all socials for further info.
So that was Nick from the Man City Fans Food Bank Support Group talking about the action going on this weekend. We got two chances to add to the pot. We will start with that Southampton home game. Michael, what are you having for this?
Yeah, I think it'll be a comfortable City win. Southampton have a habit of gifting goals to the opposition side, which, I mean, City don't need much help when it comes to scoring goals. So I've gone 4-0, and yeah, I think it'll be a big win for City.
4-0, 17-2, and £85 if you're right. Dan, what are you having?
It's the famous last words, but I'm going to say 5-0 to City.
Yeah, 5-0 is 14-1 and £140. I have been torn between Southampton digging in deep and sitting in and making it really difficult and City just eking it out, or City absolutely battering them. And I've gone for the latter, 5-1, and it's 20-1 if I'm right, so £200. And that takes us over to the League Cup game at Spurs. Michael, what are you having for this?
Yeah, I've gone for Spurs winning this one, and I'm not totally sure what team Spurs will play actually for this game, which could be a factor in it, but I think City will rest and rotate, play a couple of youth team players possibly. So 2-1 Spurs have gone, and listen, City don't tend to come away from Spurs with a win anyway, so...
Yeah, they've had a couple recently. Let's not push our luck here. 7-1 and £70. I've gone for a 1-1 draw after 90 minutes, which kind of exonerates me either way if they do that and they go through or they go out. That's 11-2 and £55 if I'm right. Dan, what are you having?
I think they'll go down in a hail of bullets and lose 3-2.
Excellent. 18-1 and £180 if you're right. Remember, you've got to be 18 or over to gamble. Prices can change. And for information on responsible gambling, take a look at begambleaware.org. Now, we're all still waiting for news on Guardiola's future and hoping that he decides to extend his stay in Manchester. But if truth be told, we've had Pep sit it for much longer than we anticipated we would when he first arrived in 2016. During that time and in the years leading up to his arrival, City have built a system designed for both him and the team to thrive. Simon Bakowski's new book, The Blueprint, details all the work that's gone into making City the club that they are today. I've been speaking to him about it and why he decided to write it.
It started around the time City were winning the treble, and, you know, the thought was, is a treble book the thing to do, how they won the treble? But then it kind of felt like there was more interest in how they got to a place where they could win the treble, how they got to a place where they could get Guardiola, and how, you know, they got to a place where Sheikh Mansour took them over in 2008, I guess. The more you kept going back, it was almost like you end up at the Big Bang or something. But it just kept going and going. And so there is a lot about, you know, the impact that Pep has had, and the players that they bought during that time. But then there's also a lot on, you know, Cheeky Bagirison and Ferran Soriano, and even before them, you know, going back to sort of Jim Castle in the academy, way before it was even called an academy, kind of the building blocks that City put in place that all gave them the platform to get to where they are today.
Yeah, it's like a series of sliding doors moments, isn't it? Because you read about the chapter with about Jim Cassell and signing Phil Foden and all of that sort of stuff is pre kind of everything that's happened in the last kind of few years, and yet because they all fall into place at the right time, they all kind of come together at one moment in 2023, I guess.
Yeah, and I mean, one of the most fascinating sliding doors moments for me is 2003, because City are opening their new stadium that they've managed to get because of their kind of back-to-back promotions and the work of David Bernstein and Franny Lee, etc. And they open it against Barcelona. And Barcelona are at a really interesting time in their period where they just had this mega election where the outsiders won. And the outsiders were Cheeky Bagirison and Ferran Soriano. And if they'd not won, then Pep Guardiola would have been sporting director for Barcelona. And instead, he kind of goes off to Mexico under Juanmar Lilo, and Lilo would have been the coach. So they kind of are on opposite sides. So it's one set who turn up to Manchester for this friendly to open the new stadium. But then everyone ends up reunited in Istanbul 20 years later. So it's kind of funny how two kind of very divergent paths end up coming together.
What was the motivation for writing this? Because the more I was reading through it, the more it kind of felt like, because like you're not a City fan. We've kind of said this on the podcast before, but yeah, there's so many points in this book where it feels like you're prevailing against what is the general narrative around City. It's like you've covered City for what is it now? Just gone 10 years.
Yeah,
and you kind of it almost feels like there's so many. It's like a MythBuster after MythBuster exercise.
Well, I suppose my frustration with some prevailing narratives is that because I cover the club every day and on a granular basis, you know, I can't turn up to Wolves on Sunday and write, oh well, City beat Wolves because Sheikh Mansour took them over in 2008. Because, like, that doesn't explain it for me. You know, you have to dig into kind of what is relevant on the day and the week and the month. And, you know, I've always been a bit of a nerd and love details and things like that. So getting to kind of talk about the, you know, the performance team backing Guardiola up and, you know, all the data. Because, again, City isn't really talked about as a club that is kind of data friendly, and it's not in the way that Brighton or Brentford are, and it's never going to be kind of the Moneyball story that Liverpool kind of have, but they do use it a lot, and it is central to a lot of what they do, right down to sort of expected goals being the fundamental part of their game model. So, like, it was a lot of those things for me, because I just think it's lazy to say, well, City are successful because of money or because of 115. Like, you can't say that City got 100 points because of some alleged inflated sponsorship deal in 2008. It just doesn't make sense to me. So it was kind of going through all the things that are behind the title successes. I get your point. It does kind of come across as myth busting. Maybe I've tried to avoid kind of, you know, putting my opinion through too much, but obviously, yeah, though my opinion essentially is that, yeah, these are all the things responsible for City's successes rather than just money, because everyone's had money. And yeah, like whatever happens to 115, there's a lot of work that has gone on that have put City where they are.
Yeah, I was going to say it's not kind of like the sole kind of reading of the book, but it just kind of feels like a constant through line that people say this, actually there's more to it than that.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, there's I wouldn't say it's an entirely positive book, and, you know, City have kind of ended up in places where, at points where they've not entirely expected to. You know, I think the whole concept of the City Football Group has kind of evolved beyond their original dreams. And, you know, there's stuff in there about the owners and, you know, it's not a fully wonderful relationship and things like that. But it mostly it's just kind of a look at how the club has transformed over the last 25 years and what has kind of remained from the time when they weren't that successful around the turn of the millennium.
Yeah. Now, there's a lot in there about the importance of key figures, as you say, and one of them is Cheeky. Obviously, since you've written this, it's been announced that he's leaving.
How, from
kind of how you've seen previous succession plans and things like that, how do you think they'll deal with that change to Hugo Viana?
I think it's really interesting. I think I might have written in the book that Bigirisson, yeah, it's a really significant change, because Bigirisson and Soriano really have basically been the best in the business for the last 12 years or 15 years, 20 years counting Barcelona. So just like Pep, you're going to have to find the best in class. I think Hugo Viana has a lot about him or a lot going for him. But it's difficult, you know, there's the relationship between Bigirisson and Guardiola is so strong, and you can see why, you know, Bigirisson's reputation is better because of Guardiola, and Guardiola's reputation is probably better because of Bigirisson. Their connection as a pair has been a big part of what has made City so special. So, you know, it's obvious that Ruben Amorim pops up for Hugo Viana, because those two have been so good together at Sporting. But, the question is, can Viana have success with another manager, or can City find a manager that works as well as Amorim for Viana if Amorim is not the right choice or the best available choice at the time? So it's going to be really interesting. And also from it's not in City's hand when Pep decides to leave. They would obviously like Pep to stay for as long as possible, for at least another year. But kind of, you kind of want your sporting director and manager to be on the best page possible. So that is going to have to be sort of factored into the thinking as well.
Mm. Yeah. Why do you think Pep has stayed so long? Because you made the point a couple of times in there that, Barcelona, he was there 4 years, Bayern Munich there 3 years. I think a lot of City thought he was going to be there 3 years and done. And we've had like triple that.
Yeah. And I think it is what we've been saying, right? It's very easy to say, well, they just pay him very well, but it's the support network and the infrastructure that is in place. At Barcelona, the politics and the media are insane. At Bayern Munich, you have some very, very high profile former Bayern Munich players always ready to spout off in the media or say when they don't like something, when you do something that might be successful but isn't how they would have done it. At Man City, there just isn't that, really. He's not got that pressure. In terms of, Micah Richards, is he really going to be bothered by what Micah Richards says? But also, I do think, you know, as time has gone on, the similarities between Pep and City and Manchester have really hit home. Obviously, the arena attack was personal for him and his family. But I think this kind of, I think Pep arrived as kind of managerial royalty and, you know, gilded coming through the Barcelona Academy and at these prestigious clubs. But like, he's a Catalan at heart, and he's a guy who's striving for Catalan independence against, you know, the Spanish state, and Madrid are seen, is the big power base. And in sort of a funny way, City are kind of the outsiders in the football side of thing, and the more he's stayed, the more he's kind of bought into the City kind of beliefs about them trying to break into the top and seeing these perceived injustices. And you know, there's a story about City coming back from London in his first season and being a minute late at Euston and being turned away from the train, and you know, think how silly that is. Like a team full of footballers.
I've been there and done it. So the fact that it's happened to Guardiola and the team, it makes me feel a little bit better.
But it's silly when we do it. But imagine like Kevin De Bruyne and everyone just stood there being told, no, you can't get on this train. and that is something that, like, you know, those who came with Guardiola were like, that would never happen to Barcelona or Bayern Munich. Mm. You know, they would hold the train for you. And that was seen as kind of a negative. But Pep instead was like, no, if they don't want to hold the train for us, we'll just be here 2 minutes earlier next time. And he's kind of built on that as time has gone on, and you know, really is part of the fabric of the club now.
McCrispy strips are now at McDonald's. Tender, juicy, and its own sauce. Would you look at that? Well, you can't see it, but trust me, it looks delicious. New McCrispy strips, now at McDonald's. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
What if I told you that right now, millions of people are living with a debilitating condition that's so misunderstood, many of them don't even know that they have it? That condition is obsessive compulsive disorder, or OCD. I'm Dr. Patrick McGrath, the Chief Clinical Officer of NOCD. And in the 25 years I've been treating OCD, I've met so many people who were suffering from the condition in silence, unaware of just what it was. OCD can create overwhelming anxiety and fear around what you value most, make you question your identity, beliefs, and morals, and drive you to perform mentally and physically draining compulsions or rituals. Over my career, I've seen just how devastating OCD can be when it's left untreated. But help is available. That's where NOCD comes in. NOCD is the world's largest virtual therapy provider for obsessive compulsive disorder. Our licensed therapists are trained in exposure and response prevention therapy, a specialized treatment proven to be incredibly effective for OCD. So visit NOCD.com to schedule a free 15-minute call with our team. That's NOCD.com.
If you enjoy the show, please give it a rating and a review wherever you get your podcasts.
There is the other angle to it. You mentioned before that it's not all a positive book, because there are other things to address in there. And I wondered that we did a podcast not so long ago where you said you'd opened up the cast report and seen the top line, which says Manchester City FC did not disguise equity funding as sponsorship contributions, but did fail to cooperate with the UEFA authorities. And that, I mean, that has made it verbatim into the book. That you really like that line, because there seems to be a lot of people that don't still don't know what that judgment is, and I think it's quite a good idea to lay it out.
Yeah, and I don't, you know, I'm not like City are innocent, whatever happens. Just like I've not seen the evidence, and I respect the decisions that, you know, are made in courts or by legal professionals. So, you know, that has always been my foundation. So when people are saying, oh, well, City picked two judges or whatever, and it's like, well, no, they didn't. But, you know, if City are found to be guilty of these 115 charges, then there are serious, you know, punishments that need to happen. And I don't think they can sort of get away from being expelled from the league if they're guilty of, you know, essentially fraud for 9 years. But that doesn't necessarily take away from a lot of the work that has gone on sort of around the club with people who had no idea that it was going on, if it was going on. But the other side of it is, like, imagine if they're not guilty of these charges and everyone who's been blaming or attributing City's success to cheating, actually, it turns out, they didn't cheat at all. I mean, we know that they'll just say, oh, well, they did. You don't believe in the, you know, they fixed it or they paid it off or whatever. But it's like, for me, I think it's healthy. It's a healthy sign of democracy. I can't believe we're saying this, to accept the decisions of courts and arbitration panels. And, you know, you have to accept it because they know a lot more than you, and their opinion is worth more than you. So, you know, Cass kind of spelled it out immediately. And again, with Cass, like, it was 2-1 on a lot of things. It wasn't unanimous, and there were points, you know, Cass didn't say it was frivolous for UEFA to bring the appeal. So clearly there was a case to be heard, but on balance, it was deemed that City hadn't committed what UEFA had said. So it's really hard, isn't it, when you're talking about these things. And the book's been interesting for me, and going into kind of all the sports washing thing, like, I had my own opinion on it. And then, you know, I feel like I've learned a lot more about kind of the geopolitics of the Gulf region and things like that that I didn't know before. And, you know, the sports washing element in the book is probably where I'm most opinionated.
I was going to ask about this because, like, ultimately, sports washing is like that side of it is something that I found quite difficult as a fan of the club to kind of rationalise and get my head around, to the point where generally I just get on these days with supporting the team and ignoring the geopolitics behind it. And I just wondered kind of the process that you had to get to be able to write about it. How did you find that?
Yeah, it was really interesting. And once again, I tried to sort of defer to the experts around it. And, you know, speaking to Professor Simon Chadwick about it was kind of really useful, and other people as well. And, you know, even Amnesty International were really good and really helpful, and just trying to get your head around it. But, I mean, I came into it sort of disagreeing with the premise of sports washing, I suppose. Like, I don't think that anyone would know or care about the UAE and Sheikh Mansour if not for them owning this football club. So, you know, I don't think anyone would be bothered about the human rights or anything like that. So I don't think that that is sort of accurate. And also, I sort of disagree with the assumption that all City fans are fine with it if they support the football club, because, you know, it's a grey area that is treated as black and white. Mm. And also sports washing, kind of the idea that, oh, well, they're trying to improve the reputation with us. And it's like, well, actually, no, they're probably more likely to be trying to get one over on their neighbours or anything like that. It's not all about you. It's kind of like old school Orientalism in action. But, you know, I do think there's a lot of soft power going on, and, like, you know, when was it at the City Football Academy when they have David Cameron and the Chinese Prime Minister and Sergio Aguero taking a selfie, you know, that is an extraordinary kind of political event that has happened. But if that is the UAE, it's also the UK government trying to be seen to be sort of as pushing the Northern powerhouse and things, and their Chinese relations and things like that. So in all of these situations, again, it's sort of black and white that, oh, this force is impacting upon this. And in actual fact, like, everyone's got their own agendas and everyone's pushing their own thing. You just sort of see some of them or treat some of them more clearly than others. Like, you know, Arsenal are paying for the UK Prime Minister to have free hospitality all year. Like, is that an issue? Imagine if City were paying for Keir Starmer to have a box all season. It's just, you know, you don't want to sort of go down rabbit holes, but I think it's kind of important to point out that the ambitions and aims of City's owners are not that dissimilar to a lot of owners in the Premier League. And it's not like this pristine league was ruined by sort of City being the first club to have their own motivations.
Yeah. Final question then, Simon, because obviously a lot of this book is around kind of the project that City have put together and kind of all the building blocks of the success. We are currently in Guardiola's final season as it stands. He might sign an extension, he might not. We'll find that out later on. But when he is to leave, how do you see the succession planning going? What do you see in terms of the behind the scenes at the club to be able to prepare for what will undoubtedly be a hit to the club, because there's nobody like it?
Yeah, I think it is undoubtedly a hit, and everyone is seeing it as things are going to go down, because, you know, Guardiola is the driving force behind so much of the success. I think all City have done is kind of prepare. I suppose Pep has brought them along with him, but by giving him the perfect ecosystem and environment to thrive in, where, you know, he's a bit like the players. He doesn't have any other distractions that he might have at other clubs. He can just focus on the football. And so that is tempting for any manager. And City's success means that they can now attract the best managers in the world. You know, Xabi Alonso wanted by Real Madrid. Well, City are an attractive option. City are, you know, if you're not going on past loyalty, then City are the the most attractive option in the Premier League for Xabi Alonso or any manager, you know, Ruben Amorim as well. And also, you know, they do have this big network of City Football Group guys who they're always keeping tabs on. And kind of Vincent Kompany's stock has gone up again since he's gone to Bayern. So, you know, they have made themselves one of the most desirable destinations in world football. That will need to continue with, you know, the right decisions being made by the sporting director and the recruitment team, Soriano and whoever eventually takes over from him, and getting the right manager in place. But the sort of the infrastructure, which, you know, I think we've seen a lot of United try and copy in the last 12 months, which, again, it's called the blueprint as well, because, like, pretty much every team has copied City in some way or another. Like, so as much as they don't like City's success, they've taken parts of it that they've seen and thought, oh yeah, we can do that as well. So they have tried to do as much as they can to limit the inevitable departure of Guardiola.
Yeah. And it's out now.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Out today, which is very exciting. Yeah. On Amazon and in Waterstones and everywhere you could think of, hopefully. And it's on Kindle and audiobook and, yeah, everywhere you could want to read it, I think you can. So please read it.
Email the show through our website, bluemoonpodcast.com.
That was Simon Bajkowski talking to me about his new book, The Blueprint. It's out now and we've got 5 copies that you could win. All you got to do is email your name, postal address and phone number to bluemoonpodcast@gmail.com. That is your name, postal address and phone number to bluemoonpodcast@gmail.com. We'll pick the winners at random before next week's show, so make sure that you do that before kickoff in the game with Spurs next Wednesday. We're going to finish with a listener question. Dan, we've got 2 jingles by Higgy now, so which one would you like to hear, the first or the second one?
Neither, ideally, but I'll go for the second.
That's very harsh, but here we go.
The listener's questions. So it's the listener's questions bit. Please make sure that yours ain't shit, because Mooney won't put up with it. Yes, it's the listener's questions. The listener's questions. Thank you.
There we go. How can you not enjoy that?
Higgy knows I love him. I'm only joking. In fact, he should do a few more. He could release like an EP of them or something,
yeah,
couldn't he?
Yeah, yeah. Let's work on it for that. Incidentally, before we get to the questions, Higgy's the person that I've seen do the most incredible thing on a football pitch. It was a 5-a-side game we were playing in. The opposition had a shot, and there were backboards on the pitch, and it hit the board and went up in the air. And from midway in his own half, he just turned, it dropped over his shoulder, and he volleyed it into the top corner at the other end. It's like an incredible finish. Shout out to Higgy for doing the most...
The streets won't forget Chris, yeah, Higginbottom.
Exactly. We'll finish with one question. Andy got in touch on the emails to say, if Rodri doesn't win the Ballon d'Or on Monday, does that go to prove Bernardo correct when he said that City players are overlooked for individual awards? Michael, what do you reckon?
Probably not. No, I think it's probably more an indication that still attacking players are more favoured for these awards. I think Rodri should win it. I think he's been fantastic. Admittedly, probably a little bit of bias in there that I watch City a lot more than Madrid. It looks like Vinicius Junior is obviously going to win it. So yeah, I think it's more to say down to the different positions and who provides the goals and the attacking memorable moments rather than perhaps who controls games.
Yeah. Dan, for Rodri, does the fact that he's injured and has been injured for the last few weeks kind of, does it push him out of people's minds, do you worry?
Maybe. I hope not. I mean, we actually did we did at One Football our own version of the Ballon d'Or just after the Euros and the Copa America finished in the summer. So we'd have like the full season to analyse plus the international tournaments. And we did it like, we got the representative from one of our each language desks around the world to vote on it. So I'm sure it's equal in prestige to the real thing, really. And Vinny Jr. won that. And I was surprised by a lot of the comments that we had in it. I'm talking like 90-95% of the comments were like, that is bullshit. Rodri should win it. Because, you know, City aren't the most popular club in the world, are they? Feels like we do get kind of overlooked for things. And people, you know, aren't usually so keen to kind of jump up and defend one of our players or whatever. But a lot of people were saying like, no, Rodri deserves it. He's been the best player in the world. He's been the most consistent. He's played a big role in Spain winning the Euros and City winning the title last year. And having also done so in, you know, the treble winning season the season before and, you know, the season before that, he was really good as well. I mean, could you imagine his first season talking about Rodri being in contention for the Ballon d'Or? Like, it's mad, isn't it, really, how the journey that he's been on and what an incredible footballer he's been. So
people,
I hope that
people
he wins
forget
it.
As well, you know, that first Champions League final when he was left out of it and he was devastated to be left out against Chelsea.
Yeah.
The reason he was left out is because he kept giving the ball away in the knockout phases.
Yeah, exactly. I hope he wins it because it would sort of send a bit of a statement out, especially in this kind of post-Messi-Ronaldo era. And there's no real clear like best player in the world at the moment, I think. I think Vinny Jr. had a good year, like a really good year. But I don't think he was like outstanding. I don't think it's an open and shut case, really. And I think it would be nice to send a message to say that like it doesn't always have to be like an eye-catching attacking player that wins these awards. We can give them to someone who's like really consistent and just a great footballer like Rodri is, a great all-round player. But I have a feeling that he probably will miss out on it, possibly because of the injury and possibly because, like I said, it's just attacking players are just favoured when it comes to these individual awards, which I generally think are a crock of shit anyway. But, you know, if Rodri wins it, I might change that opinion. Haaland was robbed last year as well, by the way. I thought he should have got it when Messi won it, but because it's Messi and he won the World Cup, he got it. So It's time. It's time we got something like this, I think.
Yeah. Michael, are you gonna tell us that Rodri is going to win it now, or is it going to be Vinny Jr.?
You know better than me, mate. It looks like it could be Vinicius Jr., doesn't it? But I also think, actually, I was going to add there, that I do sometimes think that as amazing as City's play is, it's so good collectively that sometimes the individuals don't stand out as much. And I do think that when it comes to individual awards, and like, for instance, the PFA Team of the Year last year, there was more Arsenal players than City players. That's probably because Arsenal's players are just not given a platform more to impress, but it's just the team is so good that Guardiola puts together that actually sometimes you don't notice what the individuals do. And sometimes I think that what Rodri does every weekend does go unnoticed. So no, I hope he does win it. I think I agree with what Dan said. I think it'd be a good, it would show really almost where the power resides really in a football team and a football pitch, that, you know, the attacking players very often finish off these moves and get all the credit. But actually it's the players in the middle who are pulling the strings who really deserve more of the credit.
It's the age old problem, though, isn't it? That Guardiola's only good because his players are good, and the players are only good because their system players in a Guardiola team. It's like they both of those things can't be true, but apparently they are.
And Guardiola's ruined football. You know, nobody scores long range goals anymore except City, who've got the most long range goals in the league this season. But again,
And everyone just stands on the ball now and doesn't do anything because of Guardiola. So.
Yeah, looking forward to that. I'm looking forward to that tactic filtering down to Sunday League. There we go. That's the end of this week's Blue Moon podcast. Thank you very much for listening. Thanks also to my guests for this one, Dan Burke.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And Michael Plant.
Yeah, thanks very much, mate.
Michael, we got to the end of this without you even mentioning that Villa are absolutely storming the Champions League table.
Yeah, they're flying, aren't they? They really, really are doing brilliantly. Watched the match the other night and, you know, they're up there now. You know, they're not the same level as City or anything, but they are pushing, you know, that tier of clubs below the likes of City, Arsenal, Madrid. Yeah, we'll see. I don't think they'll get too far, but who knows? Who knows? It could be a City Villa final.
Excellent. Well, I wish you all the best in the rest of the European campaign, apart from if you do come up against City. Don Farrell was my guest for this week's Nostalgia Show. We were inducting Daniel Van Buyten into the Cult Hero Hall of Fame. That episode is out now and available from our Patreon page, and there's a clip of it coming up. I'll be back next week after the games with Southampton and Spurs. See you then.
That was the Blue Moon Podcast. Please give the show a rating and a review where you can. And don't forget, you can listen without the ads by signing up to our Patreon. You'll also get an extra episode each Monday. Here's a clip of this week's.
I do remember that game pretty vividly, like watching it at home on the telly. Mainly because, as you say, really good 90-minute City performances weren't generally the thing in that season. But on the back of winning the derby, they'd gone to Elland Road and played really, really well. And I remember Van Buyten being brilliant that night, and then he gets absolutely done by Alan Smith and Alan Wiley. Another reason that game stands out is I just started going out with a girl in sixth form who, for reasons my younger self would have to explain, thought it'd be a good idea to bring her around to my house to watch the football with the family. And I remember on that sending off, my dad really trying to be on his best behaviour in front of, you know, new friends or my new girlfriend, and trying not to like just F and blind and all sorts. But in trying to contain himself, he ended up just booting like a little cushion flying across the living room. It was like a sort of a little bit of a sort of a Victor Meldrew, Basil Fawlty kind of like trying to like keep the anger in, but just volleyed this cushion across the room when Smith got Van Buyten sent off. So I remember that's like a weird thing.
Excellent.
To stand out.
I've not found footage of it since, but there's nothing on this earth that will convince me that Smith was actually fouled there.
You can listen to more of that at patreon.com/Blue Moon Podcast, and join us again next time for another episode.